The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com, Let Young Black Girls Play with Fashion. This article was written by Ayanna Ishmael on October 24, 2025. And there is a note. In this op-ed, style editor Ayanna Ishmael addresses the systemic racism young black girls like Northwest and Blue Ivy face when it comes to fashion discovery and personal exploration. Every time Northwest is paparazzied in a new outfit, the internet has the same conversation about her clothes and appearance being too grown up. The policing of black bodies is an inextricable part of Western culture that young black girls, even the most famous of them all, cannot escape. In reality, the conversation around Northwest has little to do with the 12-year-old's actual appearance. It's a prime example of implicit bias, sometimes outright racism, and the adultification of young black girls. Throughout history, black women's bodies have been ostracized, put on display, and ridiculed for things out of their control. Black girls are often perceived as more adult, regardless of how young they truly are, their bodies being used against them and sexualized when they deserve to simply be kids. As the daughter of Kim Kardashian, Northwest has been thrust into the limelight because of her ultra-famous family. Therefore, it becomes quite impossible for her to avoid constantly being perceived by the internet, and her fashion choices are always at the top of those critiques. Last Halloween, some headlines suggested that Kardashian was under fire for letting North wear a corset top as part of her costume. In a now-deleted video from North's joint TikTok account that she shares with her mom, North is seen wearing a strapless Princess Tiana costume, while her other friends, who all seem to be around the same age as her, don other Disney princess costumes. It's important to note that one of North's friends is wearing a strapless Moana costume in the video. The juxtaposition is glaring. The hypercritical focus being on North when the other young girls in that video are wearing similarly styled costumes not only signifies the societal pressure black girls are forced into, but the added layer of what it means to be a famous black girl right now. Why should North be forced to alter her Halloween costume to make adults comfortable, when her friends can wear similarly trendy costumes? Her sartorial self-exploration is fundamental for growth, without online watchdogs adjudicating her choices. A few weeks ago, Entertainment Tonight used the phrase, "looks all grown up," in a headline when referencing North wearing a black corset and pleated skirt with newly dyed blue hair. At face value, the language might seem harmless, but it's yet another method of the adultification bias that young black girls like Northwest face. According to a report from Georgetown Law's Center on Poverty, as early as age 5, black girls are more likely to be seen as older, more mature, and less in need of comfort, protection, or guidance than their peers. When I was 9 years old, I went to a Cece's Pizza with my best friend and her mom for lunch. The cashier stopped me because of the kids' meal my friend's mother had purchased for me. She asked if I had my birth certificate with me and said I didn't look 10. I remember feeling embarrassed as I watched my best friend's mother call my mom to prove my age. They ultimately let me in with the kids' meal price, but that moment never left me. I was taller than most girls my age and had stopped wearing a training bra at age 8. I was forced to confront my body in ways my non-black friends didn't have to at such a young age. It was ingrained into me, and so many other young black girls, that our developing bodies were the problem, not how the people around us reacted to them. I spent most of my childhood hiding myself behind oversized jackets and hoodies, something Northwest wears a lot of, but those outfits are never talked about, because I was more developed. I never got the chance to find my own personal style growing up, and still, at 27, I sometimes sink back into the tween version of myself, worried that a low-cut top, which all my friends would wear without hesitation, is too revealing and will bring me unwarranted attention. Young black girls deserve to have fun with fashion and try the trends their non-black friends are trying out, because those are the most pivotal years to see what excites you. Fashion trends and beauty trial runs are what every girl deserves, but for some, that practice isn't promised because they're forced to shoulder a responsibility that isn't theirs to bear. The reality star and mogul got candid about her daughter's evolution in the public eye. On a recent episode of the Call Her Daddy podcast, Kim Kardashian spoke out about the internet's discourse about North's outfits. It's really hard, and it's really interesting, because all the kids are wearing the same things. But then my daughter tries to wear it, and then I'm like, okay, we're never wearing that again. Unfortunately, we made that mistake in front of the whole world, Kardashian said. And she's, you know, usually a girl who dresses like a tomboy most of the time. She wanted to try something that her friends were wearing and went to the same place that they went to, and they all got these outfits. This idea that Kim needs to cover North up is intrinsically connected to victim blaming. Young black girls shouldn't have to live in fear of being sexualized or being deemed grown because they, like any other young girl, want to find what types of outfits make them feel confident. This kind of adultification that so many young black girls face is an example of systemic racism and respectability politics, and it's also perpetuated within the black community. A phrase like too fast, which insinuates that one is engaging in sexual activity at an early age, commonly comes from the mouths of black adults. That then enforces a shift of responsibility on the child, when young black kids deserve for their younger years to be just as sartorially explorative as white children. Of course, historically speaking, black children have been forced to grow up quickly because of slavery and segregation. But in the modern age, despite ongoing systemic issues plaguing black children, we should not let fashion be yet another challenge. Often deemed frivolous, fashion discovery is a primary way in which young people can communicate and connect with those around them. Northwest isn't the only young, famous black girl to deal with this type of dehumanizing narrative. Blue Ivy, the 13-year-old daughter of Beyoncé and Jay-Z, has faced vitriol throughout her entire childhood for her appearance, Just last year, while attending the Mufasa the Lion King premiere, internet users claimed the strapless dress worn by Blue was inappropriate when there was nothing remotely revealing about the ball gown. It was, in fact, more about the young black girl wearing it. The same thing happened to Shay Moss, daughter of rapper Bow Wow and dancer Joey Chavez, whose 2025 BET Awards outfit had a hip cutout they'd initially missed when approving the look. She had to deal with thousands of grown-ass people talking about her. "That's just a mistake that's not going to happen again," Chavez said in a live video, one she posted because her daughter asked her to say something because people were attacking her. According to Chavez, Moss didn't have a backup outfit and had to walk the carpet anyway. "When we are critical and hyper-aware of black children's bodies, especially in connection to their clothes, we're not giving them the chance to make mistakes with fashion, the way non-black kids get to. Sometimes things are out of their control. Sometimes they're just trying to be like everyone else. Sometimes they're finding their personal style, one trend at a time. And instead of brutally criticizing, we should just let them live." Our next article from theteenmagazine.com. Breaking barriers as the only girl on the boys' soccer team. This article was written by Audrey Chung on January 19th. "Ball!" I screamed at the top of my lungs. It didn't matter how loud I was. I was wide open, but my teammates would have rather taken on three defenders at once than pass to me. Because my school does not have a girls' soccer team, any girls who want to play are forced to join the boys' team, an unappealing offer for many. As the only girl on the varsity team my junior year, I was often treated unfairly despite my skills being on par with the boys. I'd been playing club soccer for over 8 years, and yet I was always benched while my teammates, who had barely touched a ball until that season, would start. It frustrated me how my performance alone was never enough to erase the doubts my teammates and coaches had for me. The mistreatment I received. I'd been sitting on the bench at a game, making commentary on the plays as I watched the team get blown out. I was hoping that the coach would overhear my detailed insight on what was going wrong and think to put me in. I was wrong. At halftime, just as the coach was almost finished yelling at the players, regurgitating all the comments that I had originally made, he looked at me and retorted, "Even players who don't know anything about soccer can see what you're doing wrong." My eyes widened, and my jaw dropped in pure shock. I turned to look at our team manager, another girl who had played the previous year but quit due to mistreatment, and she had the same expression. At practices, the coach would find other ways to intentionally humiliate me. He made every conditioning drill a race, knowing I'd always come in last. 20 push-ups and 20 extra sprints to whoever is last. "That's not fair," I responded. I knew that he knew what he was doing. This wouldn't have been a race had I not been there. "I'm sorry, do you want to make that 30 push-ups and sprints? 40? He shot back. I glared. After the conditioning drill, yes, I was last. A lot of the boys were folded over or on the floor trying to catch their breath, having not conditioned since last year's season. Though I was slower than everyone else, I was still in shape from club season and was able to stay standing straight. After the coach gave a long lecture about the importance of having to get back into shape, he pointed me out as an example. I glared again, making a point to look around at my teammates breathing heavily on the floor, but he easily dismissed me. Finally, as I untied my laces at the end of one practice, I overheard a team huddle I wasn't invited to. "You wouldn't want her taking your spot," my coach said, as a threat to motivate the boys. That was the final straw. It was clear that I wasn't wanted or tolerated there. The turning point. I talked to some of my friends on the team, ranting about the whole situation and getting angrier as I did. I felt like few of them actually felt empathy for me and understood what I was going through, while the others told me I was just being dramatic. I told them it was hard to understand unless they were put in my position. The little things that I noticed about how I was being treated easily went over their heads because it was happening to me, not to them. I continued to advocate for myself. I wanted to be assessed by my effort and skill, not by shallow assumptions. However, the few friends I had that actually trusted me were enough to change everything. They handed me the ball when no one else would, or offered to be my partner during warm-ups when no one else did. Despite initial backlash from some, I realized that by advocating for myself, I didn't need to convince everyone. It only took a couple people to trust me to shift how others began to see me, as well as how I began to see myself. Even now, there are some people who don't see the value in me as a player, and maybe never will. But instead of waiting to be welcomed in a space that was very clearly designed against me, I know now that I need to step forward to create my own opportunities. While the number of girls on the team has drastically declined from the past few years, I hope that this will change in the near future, and girls will be encouraged to open new doors for each other to rework the team's current dynamic. Our next article, from theteenmagazine.com, The Rise of Book Bans in Modern America. This article was written by Anvitha Kandula on January 28th. Book bans remain between the conflicts of preserving intellectual freedom and protecting young readers. During recent years, debates and discussions surrounding book bans have intensified, often marketed as a simple battle between morality and freedom of speech. However, the issue is far more complex. Although censorship presents serious risks to democracy and education, concerns about exposing minors to explicit or developmentally inappropriate material are also valid and deserve thoughtful consideration. At its core, book bans raise the fundamental questions regarding who decides what knowledge is acceptable. When books are removed from classrooms or libraries, they are particularly addressing race, gender, history, or identity, resulting in the silencing of marginalized voices. A recent example of this can be seen through George Takei's They Called Us Enemy, which made the banned book list from 2020 to 2025. It's often banned alongside books on the Holocaust and various other books by LGBTQ+ authors, falling into categories recently targeted by book challenges. School boards have spoken out against the graphic novel, citing vague regulations such as Tennessee's Age-Appropriate Material Act as a justification, despite the book's factual account of Takai's experience on the forced removal of Japanese Americans and their incarceration of over 125,000 individuals. This further shows America's efforts to silence authors from underprivileged groups and their efforts towards censorship in order to keep Americans from gaining trivial knowledge, which has led to a disproportionate targeting of works by authors of color and LGBTQ+ individuals. Texts like these are constantly banned because they challenge dominant narratives or force readers to confront uncomfortable truths, specifically regarding the American government system. Particularly, this can be exemplified by Takai's novel, which details the government control over the Japanese Americans after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and national security fears. Takai presents his firsthand experience growing up when Executive Order 9066 was implemented, stripping the rights and labeling Japanese Americans as enemy aliens. The banning of this book presents censorship towards texts that present firsthand realities of previous government intervention during historically significant time periods, and shows how this limits students' abilities to think critically and understand the complexity of the world they inhabit. However, acknowledging the dangers of censorship doesn't require dismissing concerns about explicit content. There is a meaningful distinction between banning books to suppress ideas and restricting access to material that is graphic, sexualized, or inappropriate for certain age groups. Parents and schools have legitimate roles to ensure that children are not exposed prematurely to content that is closer to pornographic than literature. Age-appropriate guidelines, parent involvement, and contextualized education are reasonable and necessary tools. The issue arises when these concerns are used as a blanket justification for removing books that are not explicit, but merely honest. Discussions of sexual identity, consent, trauma, and puberty are not inherently inappropriate. In fact, avoiding these topics altogether can leave young people uninformed and vulnerable. Labeling such books as dangerous often reflects discomfort rather than actual harm, and that discomfort should not dictate educational policy. True protection lies in discretion, and instead of sweeping bans, schools can implement review committees that allow families to make informed choices. This approach would respect parental concerns while preserving students' access to diverse perspectives. Overall, book bans become dangerous when they prioritize fear over education. A society that removes stories instead of engaging with them risks raising readers who are shielded, not prepared. The goal should not be to decide which ideas are allowed to exist, but to guide young people in navigating them responsibly. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. K-pop Demon Hunters Audrey Nuna made a powerful political statement at Grammys 2026. This article was written by Alyssa Hardy on February 1st. K-pop Demon Hunters stars EJ, Rayami, and Audrey Nuna know how to use fashion to tell a story, and the Grammys 2026 were no different. While the group, which makes up the singing voices for the animated trio Huntrix, typically coordinates for awards shows like the Golden Globes, this evening was a chance for each of them to make a statement on their own. Nuna's look in particular had a strong meaning about her family and the important contributions of immigrants to the fashion industry. "I'm wearing Tom Brown couture tonight," she told E! In an on-carpet interview. "It's a very meaningful look for me because I'm obviously a proud daughter of immigrants, and our story of survival is around clothing manufacturing, and Tom Brown was the first brand that my grandfather fulfilled orders for." This wasn't the first time she made a point to talk about her grandfather. She also wore Tom Brown for the Golden Globes in January. "When my grandpa moved to the U.S., he had to start his entire life over. He worked tirelessly to build his business in clothing manufacturing over the course of many years," she wrote on social media. At a time when immigrant workers across the United States, including in clothing manufacturing, are grappling with increased immigration enforcement by ICE, Nuna's look is a poignant statement about how immigrants are at the very heart of the fashion industry. Her fellow Huntrix members also wanted to highlight meaning through fashion. "I don't know if I'm feeling right now out of body," EJ said during her E! Interview. She wore a custom Dior by Jonathan Anderson. Ami also wore a custom look from the Korean brand Givenchy, featuring the national flower of Korea. After already winning tonight, K-pop Demon Hunters stars EJ, Rayami, and Audrey Nuna made Grammy's history as Golden became the first ever K-pop song to win at the Grammys. We have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.